woman says they were in it together, she means their marriages were constituted by an intricate web of imagination and ritual. Imagination in the sense of picturing who they are every day, seeing themselves and their surroundings in a picture in their mind, an image. Ritual in the sense of those daily routines that our social fabric out of which our lives are made. Donna Durgan was so naively enmeshed in this web that she could not even imagine the possibility of a woman with children who was not married. Ellen and Lynn could imagine it, but they could not, nay, would not speak it. And the rituals that constituted much of the fiber of their marriages was found not only in the coffee-clatch conversation recounted here, but also the picnics with Hawaiian punch and bologna sandwiches, the canasta, and the graham cracker crumbs. In the world of 1959 suburban Long Island, everyone was married, or so it seemed. The presence of a divorced woman spoke the lie to this world, so the word simply could not be spoken. I do not tell this story to discuss suburban marriages as such, but rather to focus on the socializing rituals that form who people are and what truths they live in. It is not just suburban marriage that is so constituted. In one form or another, all the worlds we live in are constituted by rituals and imagination. All the truths we inhabit are structured, upheld, and formed by a cultural apparatus. It is also the case that all the truths we inhabit are susceptible to the effrontery of being construed otherwise. In his essay, Truth and Falsehood, Paul Ricoeur describes a twofold movement of dogmatization and problematization. The words themselves, besides being difficult to pronounce, are a little troubling. Dogmatization and problematization, because usually, if you think of those two words, dogmatization and problematization, if you ever think of those two words, usually you think of them pejoratively. Ricoeur does not, however, intend that these words be thought of negatively, but rather that they are two sides of a dialectic. Dogmatization is the name Ricoeur gives to that phenomenon of not forever evaluating one's principles, options, of not calling into question one's fundamental values. Did you hear that? It is not forever exploring options or not calling into question values. That is, we have an unstated, implicit, and underlying order of values that, as Ricoeur says, allows us to decide quickly and free the path of hesitations which beset daily decisions. At any given moment, we don't have to decide whether we should take this action or that action. We know almost immediately how to act, what to do, what not to do. For instance, when we are angered by the cruelty of a competitor, we do not stop and think and decide it is morally wrong to kill the person. It's already there. It's a part of our unquestioned selves. We are dogmatized. And it's good. Otherwise, every single occasion would require us to think anew and to start from scratch. As Ricoeur says, this idea of the segment, this idea of the sedimentation of our choices, constitutes for us an ethical world, a conception of happiness and of honor, which is our personal moral code, more like the treasure of great civilizations. A whole history, both individual and collective, is thus contracted into a stable order. Returning for a moment to the women sitting in Ellen Hennessy's living room, they do not have to think about being married. They are married. They know how to act each day because, in Ricoeur's words, of the sedimentation of choices, the contracting into a stable order, an order they inhabit together and reinforce in each other. But when Nora moved into the neighborhood, the dogmatization is confronted by the problematization. That is, what is unthought and goes unquestioned is suddenly thought and questioned. Ricoeur describes problematization in this way, but it is enough to have once doubted an old prejudice, a custom, or a conviction, in order for everything suddenly to become shaky and the ethical world to manifest its precarious condition. The result is an endless questioning which assails the main supports of our ethical actions, and the vertigo of the ethical condition lays hold of us. The vertigo of which Ricoeur speaks is the common ailment of anyone who has assumed that faith was faith, that everyone believed what they believed, only to discover that it just ain't so, that others are genuinely other, and not just a reflection of my views and attitudes. Problematization maybe another way of saying that truth is culturally shaped and formed. Dogmatization may be another way of saying that truth is supported and nurtured in the rituals and imaginings of a culture. In the present moment, we may be more attuned to the cultural shaping of truth because we are, as James Davison Hunter says, involved in culture wars. We are aware that there are versions of the truth vigorously competing one with another, long dominant ways of imagining such central cultural and social practices as marriage, family life, work, education, and democracy are being challenged and opposed by alternate, competing, and occasionally compelling ways of imagining. Hunter himself describes this as the collapse of a cultural consensus. You see, when we are enmeshed in a tightly formed cultural consensus, it is difficult to imagine that things might be other than they are. What is, and cannot be otherwise. What is true is apparent and ready at hand. Everyone knows that it's true. But if a dangerous word is spoken, a word that says is not, then truth becomes tendentious, less certain, threatened. The dogmatic becomes problematic. In the play Inherit the Wind, The famous Scopes monkey trial is dramatized. You remember John Scopes, the Tennessee biology teacher who dared to speak the dangerous word evolution. He's on trial. In a climactic scene of the play, the prosecuting attorney, through a quirk of legal maneuvering, ends up being a witness. The prosecuting attorney is Matthew Harrison Brady, that's his name in the play, and he's being cross-examined by Henry Drummond, the defense attorney. And after a lively exchange, Brady complains, "I'll tell you what he's trying to do. He wants to destroy everybody's belief in the Bible and in God." "You know that's not true. I'm trying to stop you bigots and ignoramuses from controlling the education of the United States, and you know it. How dare you attack the Bible?" "The Bible is a book, a good book, but it's not the only book. It is the revealed word of the Almighty. God spake to the men who wrote the Bible." "And how do you know God didn't speak to Charles Darwin?" "I know because God tells me to oppose the evil teaching of that man." "Oh, God speaks to you?" "Yes." "He tells you exactly what's right and wrong?" "Yes." "And you act accordingly?" "Yes." "So you, Matthew Harrison Brady, through oratory, legislation, or whatever, pass along God's orders to the rest of the world. Gentlemen, I'll have you meet the prophet from Nebraska." Is that the way of things? God tells Brady what is good, to be against Brady is to be against God? No, no, each man is a free agent. Then what is John Scopes doing in the Hillsborough jail? Suppose Mr. Scopes had enough influence and lung power to railroad through the state legislature a law that only Darwin could be taught in the schools. Ridiculous, ridiculous. There is only one great truth in the world. Yes, yes, the gospel according to Brady. God speaks to Brady and Brady the world. Brady, Brady, Brady Almighty. What if a lesser human being, a Scopes or a Darwin, has the audacity to think that God might whisper to him, that an un-Brady thought might still be holy? Must men go to prison because they are at odds with the self-appointed prophet? Let us extend the testaments. Let us have a book of Brady. We'll hex the Pentateuch and slip you in neatly between Numbers and Deuteronomy. The Matthew Harrison Brady character lives on the edge of a collapsing cultural consensus. And he flails against the encroachment of dangerous words, in this case, Darwin's words. His is a fully dogmatized world. He goes without thinking. In fact, at one point in the cross-examination, Drummond wants to know Brady's opinion on a matter, and he asks him, "What do you think?" To which Brady answers, "I do not think about things that I do not think about." Drummond quickly responds, "Do you ever think about things that you do think about?" He is, for the most part, able to avoid the problematization. But the dangerous words are still there. They are words that assault his assertion that there is only one truth in the world. He is a warrior in the culture war. Truth that has been embodied, enmeshed, carried by the rituals and imagination of a particular culture, that truth is sent reeling when it encounters difference, a variant. A dangerous word. Our time is hardly any different from that time. We too stand at the edge of a collapsing cultural consensus. And there are many who flail against the encroachment of dangerous words. They may no longer be Darwin's words. They are instead whose? Jocelyn Elder's, or Robert Mapplethorpe's, or Louis Farrenkamp, or the latest rapper, or maybe even Newt Gingrich's, or Rush Limbaugh's. Who knows? It is only that the assertion of the one great truth in the world is difficult to maintain. In a splendid essay entitled Truth and the Wisdom of Enduring, Edward Farley describes what he calls the diminishing sphere of religious truth. Farley claims that truth has a history, and that in Western Christian religion and theology, he says, the direction of this history has the character of erosion, or to change metaphors, a selling off of formerly claimed reality territories. Farley's retracing of this history is more complex than I can do justice to here. But suffice it to say that once Western Christianity's claim to truth included a comprehensive metaphysic, an official geography, an anthropology, an account of the origin, structure, and final destiny of the cosmos, a history of the human race, ethics, and a church polity. But one by one, the pieces of the truth real estate were sold off. The first to go was the claim to a geography and planetary scheme. All right, so the truth of religion doesn't cover that territory anymore. It still has much to say about many other things. But before too long, the authoritative claims to historical fact were sold off. And then the metaphysic. In this century, in the thoughts of such great theologians as Paul Tillich or Karl Rahner, the truth claim of Christianity has been staked on a piece of remaining real estate, that real estate called the universalizable ontology of the human condition. You remember reading Tillich, don't you? In these latter days, however, even these claims are discredited and the remaining truth real estate is confined to the bounds of a historical particularity. The reaction of Brady, or any of us for that matter, to the loss of previously occupied truth territory is defensive. The oscillation from dogmatization to problematization is dizzying. It is frightening when culturally shaped and ritually inhabited truths are challenged, diminished, or discredited. The German philosopher Hegel knows this well. And he captures the sense of loss when previously held truth collapses. In a section of his Phenomenology of the Spirit, he describes the Enlightenment assault on religion. Hegel recognizes that the culture of the Enlightenment, a culture whose imagination is limited to rationality and whose rituals are contoured by critical inquiry, infects the culture of the religious. He says, it infiltrates the noble parts through and through, and soon has taken complete possession of all the vitals and members of the unconscious idol. Then one fine morning it gives its comrade a shove with the elbow and bang, crash, the idol lies on the floor. On one fine morning whose noon is bloodless if the infection has penetrated every organ of spiritual life. The erosion of the terrain that truth in religion can hold leads to a relativizing of truth. What there is left of truth is no grand claim, but the relative claim of particular cultures and communities. Perhaps because we are veterans of the culture wars, or perhaps because we have ourselves been infected with the culture of the Enlightenment, the relativizing of truth is easy enough to accept. In some way, it fits well our own cultural life, at least those of us who are able to locate ourselves in a liberal or moderate theological tradition. We value thinking and exploring, academic freedom, the pursuit of ideas. We love the metaphor of the journey and the pilgrim, and we are not so troubled by unrequited pursuits. Each of us, so we say, each of us can have our own version of the truth, our own piece of the relativized pie, and together we can celebrate our diversity. We have grown accustomed, have we not, to the vertigo, and often find it more comforting than the predictability of dogmatization. It appears easy enough for us to accept the relativization of truth, at least until one is called upon to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, which does not appear to be able to rest so easily with totally relativized truth. As Farley puts it, the situation seems enviable and at once pitiable. Enviable, from a certain point of view, is its new immunity from criticism. Its message can now be presented without making its case before juries of scientists, historians, and philosophers. Its situation is pitiable because the Christian message no longer has to do with truth at all, or at least any state of affairs, any matter of fact, any persisting reality. The gospel of Jesus Christ makes claims for truth that are not so easily relativized, not so easily distanced from a persisting reality. To preach the gospel is not simply to share one's own point of view, to put forward an opinion in the marketplace of opinions. It is rather to make the claim of truth that the gospel makes. A claim that is true not just for me in my time, but is true for all in time and beyond time. A claim that does not pass with this generation or this culture, but persists even to the end of the age. A claim that we may not fully understand, but it will be made plain in the coming of the end. The gospel, which human beings are to preach boldly, makes claims to the truth, eternal truth, absolute truth, God's truth. But there's the rub. Human beings are to proclaim this truth, and they are bound to a particular culture, a particular time and point of view. And that culture and point of view is relative. It is constituted and shaped by rituals and a shared imagination. How can such human beings preach the persisting truth of the gospel? One is tempted to say with Karl Barth that for us it is impossible, but with God all things are possible. And it's fitting and right to say just that. But there's more to say. It is not enough to simply say, God can do it. That is, after all, much like the answer Matthew Harrison Brady gives. Remember, when queried how he knows who to oppose, he appeals to the direct revelation of God. God tells me to oppose the evil teaching of that man. Brady's presumption is that he may have unmediated access to the revelation of God. His hubris is that he would know the mind of God apart from the rituals and imagination that are shaped by the culture in which he lives. His sin is that he has made of the culture through which he has come to know the gospel an idol. He has equated the mediating culture with truth. The mediation is not the truth, because the truth transcends any cultural apparatus that mediates it. It is more than culture, other than culture, but given in culture. Robert Bella makes a similar point in a recent article in the Christian Century. I don't know if you saw it just 2 or 3 weeks ago. There, Bella says, we have no unmediated access to truth. The cultural linguistic communities in which we live are only the most obvious of many mediations that connect us to our world, so that truth cannot derive from some unmediated encounter. It depends on the quality of the mediations. It is perhaps to get at this mediating aspect of truth that Vaclav Havel speaks of living in truth as something different from knowing the truth. Human beings can preach. Even more, must preach the gospel in the concrete terms of their lives, in the cultural idiom and rituals in which they live, and with the imagination they share with those around them. Preaching is to be both bold and humble. The humility is in the full knowledge that there is no unmediated access to God. Humility founded in the relative, contingent, and perspectival culture out of which we preach. The boldness is in the dangerous word that may never be reduced to any one culture, but promises God's justice, righteousness, and peace. Boldness founded in the absolute graciousness of God, who is unable to be constrained by our finitude or repelled by our fallibility. The boldness and humility of preaching issue forth into two complementary and contradictory tasks of preaching. In order for the mediated word to find a home, it must be embedded in the rituals and imaginations of a particular culture. It must be the comforting word of dogmatization. That is, preaching has the conserving function of upbuilding the common and thick rituals of the church's life. It aids in the task of us being in it together, as the women in Ellen Hennessy's Long Island living room were in marriage together, or of the living in truth, as Havel says. Bella writes of students who come to him and ask what church they should go to. They come and they often add to their question, "What church should I go to? I'm afraid I don't believe in God." And he responds, "I never tell them what church to go to, but I do say not to worry about believing in God. I tell them that if they become part of the life of the church, then they will begin to see how the word is used and what it means. Believing in God, I say, is not something one decides in the privacy of one's room, but something one comes to in a living community, which for Christians is the church. Maybe, to be realistic, it depends on the church." The dogmatization pole of preaching helps to make the church a living community that mediates the Word of God, where God becomes a word that has concrete, enmeshed, shared meanings. On the other hand, preaching is to be problematization. That is, it is to speak the dangerous word that sets off the vertigo, the word that indicates that any particular form of truth does not yet contain the full truth of God. It is a contingent and relative truth, and not yet an absolute truth. This pole of preaching destabilizes and disturbs. It speaks truth by fostering doubt. It institutes questions and gives no certain answers. It is a word that keeps the culture that mediates the gospel from becoming the same thing as the gospel. It prevents us from doing what Matthew Brady did, equating our culture with God's truth. In the productive tension between these two poles of preaching is the possibility of living in the truth of the gospel, of anticipating its triumph without triumphalism, of knowing in part what we will someday fully know. Thank you.
Truth quality. now and we'll stop. God spake. No, I think that's right. In part, I don't. Dogmatization is it's an unfortunate word in some ways because it sounds bad. But I really do. I like at least the way McClure discusses it. It is really the cultural solution in which we live. It is being a confessing community. It is being a community that doesn't ask whether God exists, but turns to God in prayer. It is a community that doesn't ask the meaning of the Eucharist, but celebrates and receives the Eucharist. It is a community that receives the forgiveness of sins, not questioning, but receives it open-handed. And I really believe that that's extremely important. And that is how we find ourselves in many ways. You know, there's a jab in that Alice Hoffman's assessment of the women, but it's all right to be married in that way in many ways. It has many redeeming qualities. It also has limitations, as does the unquestioning reception of the forgiveness of sins, because could that not also be a blessing on the sins that we do? As in receiving the Eucharist graciously without raising some question about hunger in the world. You know what I'm saying? There's all these ways in which our own cultural apparatus can be perverted and dangerous. Therefore, the problem of cessation, Paul, is opposite. Which is to set us in opposite, to hear the dangerous word from an other. It is the presence of the other, the encounter of the other, that actually rocks the boat. The woman who's divorced moves in. We experience the church in other cultures. We experience people, good people, who aren't Christian. We experience all of those others, and it calls into question our cultural construal of the truth. Now, I know that's not your question, but I wanted to at least let me make a stab at the question, see if I can got it. That is, have I set these wonderful poles? Is simply the encounter and relationship to the other the constituting part? Is that what keeps us honest? Or is there some content that there? Is that fair or do I? Sort of.
some part of the shared culture as part of, and said before, he or she can speak a prophetic word.
That's a good question. Did you hear the question? The question was, does the preacher have to be part of that culture before he or she can preach a prophetic word there? In my preaching class, I draw two overlapping circles. And I say that what the preacher does is that the preacher does not have an overlap with the community in which she or he preaches. If they don't have a cultural sharing, then they really are not even able to talk one to another. If those circles are the same, they have no, then what they're doing is they're preaching dogmatization, that is, they're preaching the choir, if you will. They're saying the same thing that everybody already knows and is right there, and there's a role to that, but one must also have some transcendent other point at which...
Yes.
gospel within the gospel. And I'm thankful for having such, but it is what you have to do, otherwise you cannot be whole. But for me, that has to do with what happens to the poor. I don't know, did you see that newspaper article just the other day? It said the number one cause of death in the world, the number one cause of death is poverty. And to me, one can exercise a certain scientific measurability. Does this construal of the gospel lead to ways that perpetuates and spreads that cause of death in the world? And if it does, then shame on us. Let's rethink what the gospel is and preach it differently. That's the establishment, the introduction of a criteria to which you can have scientific measurement. Are people dying of poverty better or worse? You can do that. There is a certain acceptability to that. There's also a limit to that. As soon as you do it, you define what poverty is. I mean, how do you define what poverty is? In part, the problem of a scientific method, and the churches love this, you know, will the church grow or not? The mega church is a message bringing more people in. It's a wonderful way to measure. It's not bad to have people in churches. That's not it. But what it is that the constituting of graciousness is constituted and shaped not by flat, objective, measurable things, but by thick rituals and common life and care. It is, I remember Annabelle Prophet, meeting with Sermon Paul in Lester, talked about an ant in whose lap she would sit, and who had a big lap. How do you measure the value of a big lap? But it is the repeated thing that assures us of graciousness maybe more than anything else. And you can't measure exactly. You can define it, you can try to measure, you can do it and have wabbiness, you know, and what not. But it's always more elusive than that. It's always broader and thicker than that. And preaching, much the way that Bill Rader did this morning, is to help us see the richness of the harvest around us and to receive that richness. Please for now. Well, in faithfulness to the Vice President for Bell Mountain.